2553, State of Minnesota versus Abdullahi Daher Salat. Council, I assume are familiar with our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial presentation, and then counsel for appellant, you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may approach, and please introduce yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Barry Edwards. That's B-A-R-R-Y of the Keller Law Offices. Frankly, I'm not sure if my name or Max Keller's is on the paperwork, but I'm the attorney of record. And I represent...
Both of you are on the briefs.
I represent Mr. Abdullahi Salad. Last name is spelled S-A-L-A-D. And I'm in the unfortunate position here today that I think I'm going to answer a lot of your questions with an I don't know. And that's not because I didn't do my work. That's not because I'm not prepared. It's because there's a lot in this case that we don't know. And that's not where we should be today. With a gentleman sitting in prison for 12 years, he shouldn't be there because we don't know the answers to questions. But that's where we're at, and that's why we're here today. I want to start with the denial of the right to testify. As the court knows, as counsel knows, the right to testify is in the Constitution. It's a fundamental right. And Mr. Salad wanted to testify. We know that. That's not one of the things we don't know. We know that because he submitted an affidavit for his petition for post-conviction relief, in which he articulated very clearly his reasons for wanting to testify. We're not speculating about that. He said that in a criminal sexual conduct case, the jury wants to hear the person who's accused say, no, I didn't do that.
Yet at trial, when he was asked, do you want to testify or not, his answer was no.
And with due respect, if that were the case...
That's true, isn't it? That's in the record.
At one point, the verbatim question was, do you want to testify or not? And the answer was no. But that's out of context. Just before that, trial counsel asked, and we all know where I'm going, this is in bold in my brief, asked, do you choose to testify or do you choose to retain your presumption of innocence? And Mr. Salad said, that's a lot of words. Then trial counsel, okay, let me say it again. Do you want to testify or not? In that first thing I just read, do you want to testify or do you choose to retain your presumption of innocence, A, or not, B? In Mr. Salad's mind, there's option A, there's option B. Option A is testify. Option B is not testify and retain your presumption of innocence.
Mr. Edwards, I thought the actual question was, because I was focusing on that too, do you choose to testify or do you choose to retain your presumption of innocence and stay silent?
I'm sorry, you're right.
I think that arguably is a very different context, that when you add those words and stay silent, isn't it?
Yes. Well, first of all, the fact that you and I don't necessarily clearly see this exactly the same way, we're kind of scratching our heads, or at least I am, suggests the problem, right? Do you choose to testify, testify, or retain your presumption of innocence and stay silent? I apologize. I thought about this analogy and decided not to use it, but I'm going to. Do you want the French fries or do you want the potato with sour cream? What? Oh, I want the potato. That doesn't mean you also don't want the sour cream. You're just saying option B.
But don't we need to look at the entire record? I mean, clearly here, Counsel had an opportunity and spent some time conferring with his client about his right to testify, and did he not, doesn't the record describe that he explained to your client that he had the right to testify, and that he was the one who had to make this decision, that no one could prevent him from testifying? Isn't that also part of the record?
That is part of the record. Two things.
And I ask this so we just don't take these few words out of context. I mean, these words were in conjunction with all kinds of other activity, right?
Yes. Okay. Your Honor said that counsel consulted with my client, and according to the record, there was a brief recess, as there usually is in these criminal trials, for counsel and client to confer privately. I don't think the court record says how long that was. They had some discussion off the record, but we don't know what that conversation was. What we do know, and this is back to my opening, you know, there's things we don't know. There's things I don't know, which is why we should have had the petition, which is why the court should have granted the petition for post-conviction relief, so we can just find out. So they had a conversation, but I've had those conversations. My day job is trial lawyer. And sometimes in those conversations, in the heat of battle, who knows what the client wants to know about, but I've got a lot of questions to answer every time. And it may or may not have been directly on point. I'll tell you what, my clients waive their rights a lot. I do a lot of plea petitions. And I ask my client, you know, I go through the litany of trial rights that they're giving up. And I say to them, instead of the one question, do you give up these rights? I ask two, do you understand these rights? Yes. Are you giving up these rights? The fact that someone says, yes, I understand these rights, which are half a dozen or eight constitutional rights about which books have been written, always makes me a little uncomfortable. And here you've got Mr. Salad being given these weighty constitutional rights, presumption of innocence, right to testify or to remain silent, right to testify or remain silent. And they've been imbricated, they've been combined, and then he says, I'm confused.
Where does he say he's confused?
He says that was a lot of words.
Well, that's not the same as saying I'm confused, is it?
That's true. Yeah, I paraphrased. He says that was a lot of words. Trial counsel took that to mean, I mean, I take, okay, let me say it again. And he didn't say, let me disentangle those two things. He said, let me say it again, it. The it is A, testify, B, don't testify and keep your presumption of innocence. I mean, for all I know, it's a clear, it's an arguable, not clear, it's an arguable reading of this that Mr. Salad thought that I want to keep my presumption of innocence, please. And then we're going to get to, and do you want to testify? That's a separate inquiry that he may very well have thought we were getting to. And again, his affidavit in support of the petition for post-conviction relief, speaking of a lot of words, says he wanted to testify. He's unambiguous about that. He expected to testify. He wanted to look the jury in the eye and say, I didn't do this horrible thing. And if you look at I'm going to segue into the insufficient evidence, but if you look at the defense that his attorney put on, and by the way, his attorney's a friend of mine. He's an excellent lawyer. I don't mean to disparage him in any way. We all get busy. We all sometimes don't do a great job. His attorney called one witness. That witness, I've got it in my notes. He's from the Somali American Foundation, Somali Community Relations Council. And he was called specifically to testify on whether Mr. Salad had a reputation for peacefulness or violence. That's not, I mean, first of all, I'm not even sure that's relevant. But there wasn't much of a defense there. And I know from Mr. Salat, from my conversations with Mr. Salat, without getting into attorney-client privilege, and from the affidavit that's part of the record, that he thought his defense was going to be that he looks the jury in the eyes, 24 eyes, presumably, and says, I didn't do this. Having the guy from the Somali Community Relations Council say he's peaceful was not Mr. Salad's understanding of his whole defense to a charge that's going to put him in prison for a decade or more. Well, 9 years to serve.
So, Mr. Edwards, is the question before us really, does it boil down to whether the affidavit submitted with the post-conviction petition can overcome the transcript of the trial, the colloquy, where he made the waiver? I mean, in his affidavit, he essentially contradicted his answer that he provided the district judge at trial. And so is the question whether the affidavit can overcome that record? And if so, do you have any case law that would show that in some situations affidavit provided on a collateral attack may contradict the waiver given on the record and allow a new trial?
I think that the law that supports, I would not put it that way, but I think the law that supports letting the affidavit speak for Mr. Salad is Minnesota Statute 590 and whatever the rest of it is, 590.02, I think, the 590.04, post-conviction relief statute, which says that when we have an ambiguity, no, I'm not saying the affidavit's right and the testimony's wrong, I'm saying we don't know what the testimony means. Do you want A or do you want B? And he says, that's a lot of words, and the counsel, and then B happens to be two things. And he says, I want B, which sounds like, I mean, I don't know if that's retaining his presumption of innocence or choosing not to testify.
Well, the final question you've quoted in your brief at page 15, do you want to testify or not? He said no. Mm-hmm. That seems pretty clear to me. Pretty clear that he does not want to testify. I can't imagine a different way of interpreting those words.
I don't mean to be flippant, but when you say you want the potato, you expect it's also going to have the sour cream.
He didn't suggest that he was confused at that point, did he?
He gave a monosyllabic. Well, first of all, he may have not thought he was confused. He may very well have been perfectly confident that he was answering the question, I want to retain my presumption of innocence.
That wasn't the question, though, that he was asked.
But the question he was asked may well have sounded to him like, do you want to remain silent and keep your presumption of innocence, or do you want to testify? I mean, do you want to testify or not? No. Not, he's saying not, which, according to how the question was initially posed, and especially with a non-native speaker and all these complicated constitutional rights, I just think, first of all, I think the trial courts, I know this has been before this court before, really need to be more careful with fewer leading questions, fewer cross-examination type questions, especially when you got the guy in the pinstripe suit, and in this case, the woman in the black robe, you know, expecting a certain answer from the guy. At that point, I don't know if he would have been comfortable saying, can we take another recess and talk about this? Because I'm confused. This isn't what we talked about when we met back in the holding cell. I don't know if he was in custody or not at that point. But someone had a question. I think the question was, is that clear? Do you want me to testify or not? No. We wouldn't be here if it was clear. I mean, I could tell you, I don't mean to be flippant or disrespectful, but I wrote a fairly lengthy brief. I studied this. I read this. I can't disentangle those things confidently, certainly not confidently enough to feel comfortable saying that his decision was, yeah, I'm not going to look at the jury and tell him I didn't do it. That's his defense. That's the defense he wants to make. My time is up. Thank you. See you in 15 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself and your client.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Heather Pippenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota, who is the respondent in this case.
Looks like where we're at this point is whether or not this is a good waiver.
Correct.
We did not have a post-conviction evidentiary hearing. Since we've got this entanglement of the presumption of innocence language that comes immediately before he's asked the question, do you want to testify or not? Would an evidentiary post-conviction hearing have been of some benefit on that subject?
The standard for granting an evidentiary hearing is whether or not there was anything submitted that would support the evidentiary hearing. In his affidavit.
We have an affidavit that says one thing, and we have the transcript earlier that said something else.
What's not in the affidavit is any indication that he chose not to testify because he wanted to maintain his presumption of innocence. If you look at what's in the affidavit, he does not say he was coerced into not testifying. He doesn't say he was confused because of the presumption of innocence language. He doesn't address that in his affidavit. That's the argument.
So
being
what you're saying is there was nothing, an evidentiary hearing, there was nothing that the evidentiary hearing could clear up.
Correct. And what you have in the affidavit essentially is him saying, I think my attorney gave me bad advice, but I followed my attorney's advice. My attorney gave me advice. I followed it. He doesn't say he was coerced. He doesn't say he was confused. He's saying, in his opinion now, that was bad advice. That may be hindsight. That may be some regret on his part based on the outcome. But that doesn't change the actual exchange that occurred on the record. There wasn't, I just respectfully completely disagree with the interpretation of what actually happened on the record and that there was any ambiguity about him saying he did not want to testify. I agree that the comment about his presumption of innocence versus testifying was not well phrased. It was not well phrased. There was some big pieces in the middle that weren't connected.
Minimal statement, it probably should not have been there.
Correct. And thankfully, I have the interpretation from the transcript that it didn't even make sense to the defendant, what had just been said to him. And he said, that was a lot of words, and he doesn't make his choice at that point. And his attorney then says, essentially, you know, let me ask this in a different way. Let me just ask it this. Do you want to testify or not? And he clearly says no. There is nothing in his affidavit that says he was coerced or convinced to do that because he wanted to maintain his presumption of innocence.
If we had an evidentiary hearing, his attorney could have been called to testify and describe what the discussions were between himself and his client. And he could have shed some light on whether no was the same answer that he expected from his client.
And again, if there was something in the affidavit submitted by appellant that would have supported that hearing, yes, that is what could have happened at the hearing. But all he's saying in his affidavit essentially
said in his affidavit, when we had our conference earlier, I told my attorney I wanted to testify.
Correct.
That's absent here.
Or I wanted to testify, but then he said I would lose my presumption of innocence if I if I testified. So that is the only reason why I didn't testify. He doesn't say any of that in his affidavit. All he says is, I should have testified in a case like that, you know, and you've read the affidavit. He basically gives all the reasons why, in his opinion, his attorney's advice was bad. So that's his argument for why his attorney was ineffective or his advice was unreasonable. That is a completely different issue than his waiver not being voluntary and knowing. And I think those two issues really need to be kept separate. And he does argue both. In this appeal, I believe he's saying his attorney's attorney was ineffective because his advice was unreasonable. He also says, I was deprived of my right to testify because my waiver wasn't submitted knowingly and voluntarily. So those are two separate issues. In his affidavit, he only addresses the ineffective assistance or the unreasonable advice issue. He doesn't provide any support for the waiver not being knowing. That is not in the affidavit, and I think that's important. And that is why the judge, looking at the record, which is very, very clear, where he, in fact, the trial attorney did exactly what Mr. Edwards seemed to suggest is best practice as he went through every one of those rights. He ended each phrase with, "Do you understand that?" He said, "You have a constitutional right that allows you to testify if you so choose. Do you understand that?" And then the client answered an affirmatively, and then he goes through it again and says, "It's not up to the judge, it's not up to the prosecutor. I can't tell you not to. It is at the end, it's your decision. Do you understand that?" So after he explains all of the rights, he clarifies that his client is understanding. And I appreciate that appellant's counsel kind of insinuated today that perhaps there was a language barrier or a language issue in this case. I would just submit there's nothing in the record to support an argument that there was any lack of understanding on his behalf. And so I'm grateful that that record is so clear and that his attorney did ask him at the end of every single one of those questions, "Do you understand that?" And all of that led up to the final decision, "Do you want to testify or not?" And he very clearly said no. So I would just really urge the court to keep those issues separate, whether or not the advice was good advice or not, versus whether or not it was a knowing and an intelligent waiver. And I would submit that it was a knowing and intelligent waiver. Appellant also makes various arguments.
Ms. Pippenhagen, yeah. So when we're analyzing this issue, do we take into account what the judge wrote in the post-conviction order, or are we looking solely at the transcript of the trial and, you know, the colloquy that provided the waiver?
Well, I think both. I mean, the record is the record, and then you review the judge's findings for clear error.
But, I mean, the judge made in the course of analyzing the ineffectiveness argument, the judge made a statement that petitioner made a knowing and voluntary waiver of his right to testify, which is incidental, I think, to the ineffectiveness argument, but that was not a statement made by the judge directly in response to the argument that appellant is making in his brief, that we're talking about, I don't think. You know what I mean? I feel like it was incidental to an ineffectiveness claim. It was not a freestanding argument of an ineffective waiver. That issue was not part of the post-conviction order.
In the post-conviction, he raises this issue a couple times. He raised it in a post-trial motion and also in his petition for post-conviction relief. I'm sorry, I think I'm supposed to be closer to this. In the petition for post-conviction relief, he did argue that his waiver was invalid because of the wording of the statement. And then he also argued that his attorney gave him poor advice regarding his decision to testify. The district court, when it denied relief, only addressed the knowing and voluntary argument. The district court did not address the claim that his attorney was ineffective in his advice, in the substance of his advice. So the court addressed, the court analyzed it under the knowing and voluntary waiver argument. And I'm not sure why she didn't address the other part. Perhaps she just missed it when she was reading the arguments, but she did not address the ineffective assistance aspect of that.
Forgive me if I'm so. Can I draw your attention? Do you have the order in front of you?
I have it in my folder. Let's see.
Save time. You can have
mine. Can I look at yours? Yeah, sure. I have it in front of me now.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. I guess I'm on page 4 is the heading Roman numeral 3, ineffective assistance of counsel, and then there's various subheadings, and this discussion about the knowing and voluntary waiver is on page 9 under subheading C. I guess it's my understanding that the district court made that, the post-conviction court made that statement in the course of reviewing the ineffectiveness claim, but maybe I'm taking the headings too literally.
Ineffective assistance is Roman numeral. She does have that as a main heading, but she doesn't address, in my opinion, when she analyzes that issue, she does not do the Strickland analysis or address the ineffective assistance. She only does an analysis on the knowing and voluntary waiver in that section. But you are correct. It is under the main heading of ineffective assistance.
Okay. Well, so to reiterate, I guess I was asked whether we consider the post-conviction court statement in our review, and your answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
On that issue, correct.
Thank you.
And obviously, appellant makes numerous ineffective assistance arguments. I think I addressed each of them in turn in my brief, so I won't go over each one of those again individually unless the court has any questions about any of those. And I wasn't planning on spending a lot of time on the sufficiency challenge, but I would submit that there was certainly sufficient evidence to support the element of penetration in this case, both based on the victim's statements to the social worker, which were admitted as evidence, and also in her testimony at trial. So I respectfully disagree with any allegation that the evidence in this case was not sufficient. Her testimony established cunnilingus. The statute clearly says cunnilingus is penetration. So that element was met. So unless the court has any other questions on any of those issues, I would forfeit the remainder of my time.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you. Mr. Edwards, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. In Someone mentioned, I believe it was Judge Johnson, but I'm not sure that we've got the whole record. In trial counsel's closing argument, just in case we weren't sufficiently confused about all of these rights and what the rights mean and what giving them up means and which ones are entangled with what, in his closing argument, and I can't give you a transcript page right now, trial counsel says, the presumption of innocence is equivalent to him denying it. And I believe that's a direct quote. He says in his closing to the jury, no, he didn't testify, but he's explaining the presumption of innocence. He's going through, you know, frankly, those things that we trial lawyers do in closing on presumption of innocence, burden of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt. And he says on the presumption of innocence, he says you're supposed to start with a blank slate. He talks about other countries and how they've got a presumption of guilt. You got to prove your innocence. But then he says the presumption of innocence is equivalent to Mr. Salad denying it. So here he's got the presumption of innocence and the right to remain silent as imbricated. Is that the conversation he had with Mr. Salad in that break after the defense rested at trial? We agree there was a break, and we
trouble
presume
is that the petition here, post-conviction, doesn't allege all of those kind of things. doesn't suggest that he's confused, doesn't say this is what my attorney told me on this business of waiver, does it?
The petition for post-conviction relief doesn't make the argument I just made, is that?
His affidavit doesn't recite any of that either.
The affidavit says that he wanted to testify. The affidavit is not every possible conversation he had with his attorney. The affidavit's limited. Frankly, he was in...
Anywhere in that affidavit does he suggest that he told his attorney in that conference that he wanted to testify?
I don't have his affidavit in front of me. I believe he does say that, but if you're saying I'm wrong and you've got it in front of you, then I'm wrong.
Well, since I read it as well, so I'm just asking you.
I believe he says that he told his attorney from day one and repeatedly and insistently that he wanted to testify. Again, he articulates why he wanted to testify. It's not unthought through. It's here's why I want to testify. The jury in a crim sex case, and he didn't have any 613 prior conviction impeachment evidence to worry about either. He had a clean record, so he didn't have to worry about being impeached if he took the witness stand. He said, and I didn't give him these words, he said, the jury wants to hear in one of these cases that you didn't do it. I mean, it sounds from his affidavit like he was expecting to testify, like he thought that was going to be his defense. And then the trial's over. And his whole defense was this one gentleman saying he's got a reputation in the community for peacefulness. He also argues, and we really spent a lot of time on this argument, which is the one I raised, which I think is the most important, but Mr. Salad believes that that his attorney didn't investigate the case, and counsel put in her brief that that trial counsel's strategic decisions are, quote, virtually unchallengeable, but she left out the beginning of that sentence. It's sort of a theme here today with, you know, things going context. It's virtually unchallengeable. The trial counsel strategy decisions are virtually unchallengeable after a thorough investigation. And Mr. Salad identified multiple people who he thought should have been talked to because they could give context for what happened that night and after that night. And I'd like to know, given the defense of just that one person from the Somali Community Relations Council, did trial counsel talk to these people? Did he send an investigator to talk to these people? And I'm talking really fast because I'm out of time now. Thank you all for considering my brief, my petition.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its decision within 90 days in writing on the internet.